Well, we'll get to more pleasant subjects now, such as the Bible, which is always more pleasant than all of that garbage. We had come last time to the middle or latter part of the 27th chapter, I believe, and I wanted to ask if there are any questions lingering over from the last couple of Bible studies. We had talked about the subterfuge involving the replacement of Jacob with Esau, and Jacob getting the blessing instead of Esau, and so on. We talked about the transferal of the birthright. Any questions involving that chapter at all? Finally, of course, if you've read ahead of me, you know that when the truth came to Esau, he wept, and he got a lesser blessing from his father, Isaac. And there is a little bit, of course, that we could read with regard to this over in Romans, and I want to turn to that and read a little bit of it now, because I think there's a great principle there. In the 9th chapter of the book of Romans, and I'll get right to it by coming to the part about the calling of the seed in Isaac, he begins to talk about Israelites to whom pertains the giving of the law, the covenants, the service of God, and the promises, verse 5 of Romans 9, whose are the fathers, and of whom is concerning the flesh Christ came, who is over all, God blessed forever. Amen. Not as though the word of God has taken none effect, for they are not all Israel, which are of Israel. Neither, because they are of the seed of Abraham, are they all children, but, it says, and he quotes, in Isaac shall thy seed be called. That is, they which are the children of the flesh, these are not the children of God, but the children of the promise are counted for the seed. Now, do you understand what that means? Because even through the birthright, and through the father to son, right on down through the lineage through which God passed the birthright, Jesus Christ, coming from the tribe of Judah, and Judah, remember, was one of the children of Leah, who was the mistaken wife that was supplanted in place of Rachel, the one that Jacob really wanted. And it is referring not only to that, but also to the spiritual children who can be begotten of God, whether they are black or of any other race. That is, they which are the children of the flesh, verse 8, these are not the children of God, but the children of the promise are counted for the seed. For this is the word of promise, quote, at this time will I come, and Sarah shall have a son. And not only this, but when Rebekah also had conceived by one, even our father Isaac, and then a parenthetical statement for the next verse, for the children being not yet born, neither having done any good or evil, that the purpose of God according to election might stand, not of works, but of him it calls. It was said in her, the elder shall serve the younger. And that was elder by only moments, because we read the story about the seizing of the heel of Esau when he was born, and how when Jacob was born, that he was called a supplanter. And of course, Esau continually was crying over that, as we saw in the last part of that chapter that we had studied. As it is written, Jacob have I loved, but Esau have I hated. What shall we say then? Is there unrighteousness with God? And that's the question you come to. Why did God allow subterfuge to actually bring about his purpose? And it's a mystery, really. A lot of people have never really understood it. Even Pharaoh is called a servant of God, and through him, that is through Pharaoh, shall my name be magnified among all nations. And Pharaoh, therefore, was an implement or an instrument in God's hands, God himself allowing his heart to be hardened. And he goes on and begins to explain a little bit about the puzzlement that we might experience, because God does not always seemingly work things out the way we would have it. Is there unrighteousness with God? Is God unfair? Does he not work it out the right way? God forbid. For he saith to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. So then it is not of him that wills, nor of him that runs, that is, whatever human effort is involved, but according to God, of God, which shows mercy. I think none of us have the concept of the cheapness of human life, on the one hand, and its priceless value, on the other hand. Human life is the cheapest possible commodity to God in one way. You cannot read the book of Revelation. You cannot read of the fact that up to two-thirds of the population of Israel are to be dead by the beginning of the captivity, that one-third are to be taken into captivity, and only a remaining one-tenth or 10% strong indication in the Bible shows, will remain alive by the time of the physical second coming of Christ. That during the day of the Lord, countless millions, tens of millions of human beings are going to perish. But you know, when God, who has the power to resurrect those human beings, is able to, at the end of the great white throne judgment, we read of in Revelation 20 and verse 5, the rest of the dead lived not again till 1,000 years were finished, is able to resurrect every last one of those hundreds of millions or even billions of human beings and to give them an opportunity to learn and to come to understand the purpose and the plan of God in a kingdom of God during the last part of the millennium, the period of the great white throne judgment, then really what is lost? The momentary pain, sometimes I suppose death is devoid of pain if it is instantaneous enough. We, as human beings, looking at our very brief lifespan, being sensory human beings with five senses through whom we can come to know everything that comes into our mind, cling to life very tenaciously. We are a thinking, feeling, hearing, smelling, tasting, saying, doing creature, and we very tenaciously cling to the fine things of this life, and we look upon this life's experience as the most precious possession we have, even above some of our vital organs or some of our members. Many one-legged, one-armed, and otherwise handicapped and crippled people are very happy to be alive. Many blind, many deaf are happy to be alive, nevertheless. And yet, on the other hand, ironically, one human life is worth more than all other human lives put together, or lives put together. Because look at it this way. If, and we do know in Romans the 8th chapter, that each human being who is begotten of God and finally is born of God is to become a member of the very family of God, on the same plane with God, because Christ is called the firstborn of many brethren, he's called the first fruits of them that slept, he's called the author and the captain of our salvation. He is also very God, even though he was human being and took on himself the seed of Abraham. And the 8th chapter of Romans explains that very thoroughly. So he now has the very power of God. And that power was creative power. Christ created. He's the being of the Old Testament who created Adam and Eve. If only one human being out of the 4.5 billion human beings were to successfully be inducted into the family of God, that family of God will be increased by 33 1/3%. It is right now composed of two beings. There is duality in the Godhead, God the Father and Christ the Son. If only one human being out of 4.5 billion were to actually achieve God-plane membership in the God family, just think of it that way. But he has proposed that millions, maybe billions of them, are to actually be born of God above the level of angels, and that he is to expand his family almost infinitely or almost limitlessly. So when you think of the value of human life from both of those totally opposing points of view, on the one hand, God, who is the creator of human life, could recreate human life. He has the power to kill you and resurrect you at the winking of an eye. And perhaps some human beings who have felt the wrath of God, like Uzzah, who tried to steady the ark, are going to be the better for it, because they're going to come back instantly and say, what happened? You're going to say, you shouldn't have touched my ark. He's going to say, oh. And I'll tell you, the next time God says, don't touch it, nobody's going to listen quite as well as old Uzzah will. His ear's going to be all perked up, and he isn't going to touch it. You know, I've always maintained that in child rearing. I'm not an advocate of beating children, of using coat hangers on them or anything like that, like some people tend to want to do. But, you know, going through the trauma of sitting in the wedged in what I call cattle class on the back end of the 727 on the way to New York and back, and having it with these little kids in there, and they're sweet little creatures and on, it's not their fault. But I guarantee it can drive you right out the walls to sit there for 2.5 or 3 hours with a screaming child. And the parent doesn't know how to turn them off. The parent will jostle them, and they'll turn them around, they'll give them a little doll, they'll try to nurse them, put a bottle in their hand, they'll pick up the thing they throw, but they don't know how to control them. That parent is about as ineffective as these people down there standing there watching a hurricane come ashore. There's really just nothing they can do about it. But there is, they just don't know it. I did it that way, and it worked perfectly. And I've got a marvelous relationship with the young men that are my sons today, and have had, except for just a few moments in teenage when we had our problems and they had their problems, but I'm just thankful for it. But I could take those three little boys, stair-step, all the way from age 1, 2, 3, 5, all the way clear up until they were big teenagers and able to tell Dad where to get off if they wanted to. But up until that time, it didn't matter. We could have little old light china pieces of bric-a-brac right down next to the floor. I had guns in a house, and not once in 14 to 17 years has one of those boys ever even lay a finger on one of them. We could go into restaurants and sit them down in their places, and all I had to do was to say, "Fold your hands, boys, and just sit there and be quiet," and they would. If I had one of them in an airliner and he started to say something, I just go like that, quiet, and he'd just be quiet. Because at home, you see, the first time I did that and he didn't be quiet, I just pick him up and spank him real good. And after he got all wore out and all satisfied and all the anxieties and the frustrations and tensions were all sort of drained out of him, I'd tell him again. If he didn't do it, spank him again. Didn't take very long. I didn't have to spank those boys very much at all. In the early formative years, I did a little bit, and Mama did a little bit, but I'll guarantee you it works, and it works perfectly. I believe you can train a parrot through repetition. You can train a parrot to talk. You can train a dog. I've seen people train 6 months old dogs with just hand commands. We've even seen them on television recently in the morning and demonstrating training a simple puppy to heel and to quit barking and to come when called. I've seen parents with little kids infinitely more intelligent than a puppy who can't get them to heel or sit or stand or come when they're called or be quiet. But there are methods whereby you can make that work. Now, God has not trained us that way yet. You are not on a short leash. You are not on a choke collar. You don't get electrical shocks. You don't answer to the whistle. God isn't dealing with you that way right now. But in the millennium, that's the way he's going to deal with people. He's going to have their attention. And the way he's going to get the attention of about 4 billion human beings or more is to put them to death. And that'll really get your attention. A whole lot more than a paddling across your bottom or something like that. When somebody wakes up and realizes he died in some horrible plague or in some war or something, he's going to say, "What happened?" And God, and maybe members of God's family, and those of us who make it into God's kingdom, and millions of angels are going to be there to tell these people what happened. And during that time, they are going to listen. So we, in our very limited, very small perceptions, do not, with our minds, reach out and see the entirety of the universe and the entire span of time and the great, awesome, global plan of God. We oftentimes deal in a very petty, a very human way with God. And so Paul, perceiving that, as people read through how Jacob stole Esau's blessing and that wasn't fair, but God honored it anyway, anticipates the question, well, is God fair? And then he shows in verse 6:15, God says, "I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy." It's not a matter of fairness for this period of time. Do you know that God in the Old Testament even allowed evil spirits, demons, to actually convey messages that were false messages to the mind of a king in order to get that king accidentally killed in order to pursue a part of God's plan? So then, verse 16, "It is not of him that wills, nor of him that runs, but of God that shows mercy. For the scripture says unto Pharaoh, even for this same purpose have I raised you up, that I might show my power in you, and that my name might be declared throughout all the earth." Now you can sit and argue endlessly, well, therefore Pharaoh didn't have a choice. Well, yes, Pharaoh did have a choice. But God works with human nature in the same way that you might work with a dog. If you wanted to teach a dog not to chase a cat, you could probably put him on a 30-foot rope and lead a cat by it 31 feet. And every time a dog hit the end of the rope, nearly broke his neck and choked him to death and so on, it just really terrified him. And after third or fourth time he hit the end of the rope, well, the dog probably wouldn't even get up and run out of the doghouse anymore. You lead a cat by finally within 2 feet, and the dog wouldn't even get up. And that's the way God will finally do it to people. He will allow your own natural human nature to fulfill his purpose, even if that, so far as your character is concerned, is not right. It wasn't right that Pharaoh did what he did. But God allowed his normal anger and his human nature to fulfill God's plan. And then God says that it was because his power would be shown. Therefore has he mercy on whom he will have mercy, and whom he will, he hardens. You will then say unto me, well, then why does God find fault? And why do you say that what Pharaoh did was wrong? For who has resisted his will? Everything is according to divine fiat or divine fate. It's a fatalistic thing. You couldn't help it. And people tend not to see volition and choice. They think God removed choice from Pharaoh. And that's the mistake. No, he didn't. But God knew, just as much as you knew the first time you led the cat by 31 feet, what the reaction of the dog was going to be. God knew what the reaction was going to be. Nay, but oh man, let's all remember where we are. We're on the earth and God is in heaven. We're just a man. Who are you that reply against God? And now you get to the heart of the question. Here we are trying to take our human reason and our awareness of what is right and wrong and apply it to the mind of God. And that's what Paul's trying to tell us. You can't do that. You can't take square and right and cube and what is upright and what is honest and moral and right and good and then go up to heaven and then try to make that fit into God's great plan, because we're just a man and we don't understand God's great purpose. Shall the thing formed say to him that formed it, why have you made me thus? You ever really think about that? I've often wondered, what in the world can a male camel see in a female camel? I mean, you can't. You ever seen a picture real close up of an old camel chewing his cud? You ever heard a camel? I've ridden on them, and I mean, they make noises. We used to take little tape recorders along and tape record these camels making his noise, and we'd go in a restaurant, turn it on, and let people hear it. Really horrible. And anyway, I used to wonder. I just was back in the early days when I was first in the college. John Hill and I used to do this a lot. We were ridiculing evolution. But you really look at a human being the way we are put together. You ever really study a human ear? I mean, really study it. Really get to thinking about it. And it really looks weird. It's in a weird place. It's in a horrible position. And some poor people are born with ears that are like, you know, a radar or a TV antenna or something else sticking out where they really think they're getting a lot of sound in there. And other people have nice little ears real close to the sides of their head. Some people have earlobes about that long that kind of hang down and flop, you know, and other people don't have any earlobes at all. They're just real close to their head. They're all shaped somewhat the same inside, and they all smell real bad. The minute a gnat goes inside, they just go crazy, trying to find their way back out, because for some reason God has equipped us with what we call ear wax, which is continually a secretion that is given off by the ear to protect it, and it's an insecticide. It's a horrible odor. If they could find some way to manufacture earwax and you could spray it around your house, you wouldn't have any mosquitoes. Have a similar odor to that. So I got to thinking one day, you know, what if the most exciting, the most attractive thing, what if our minds were different than they are, and instead of being attracted physically to things like breasts or thighs or navels or buttocks or whatever, forgive me for being honest, you know, some people claim that they are thigh men, others are breast men, whatever. I once heard it argued on television, to my profound dismay, that part of the anatomy that women, the majority, by actual survey of women, look at a man first and admire. And I'll bet some of you can't even guess what it is. But if you saw the same television show, you know. Anyway, instead of... And I'm not even going to reveal a secret. You can talk about it. You can talk about it during the break, and maybe it will get around. So I thought, what if the ear were the great attraction? We had to go around and wear little knit stockings and cover our ears. And if everybody had these little cute coverings for our ears, you know, bikini ear coverings with just a little more of the lobe exposed than other type of ear coverings. You just think of human beings a little bit. Think of the way we are put together, at the shape of our bodies. Noses are not really a very pretty thing. And the noises we make through them. There's one gentleman in the ministry I won't talk about, WCG, who literally honks his nose. And we saw a little bit of a television program about Jacques Cousteau. It's very educational and very interesting, of these elephant nose seals. And there are men that and sometimes women, unfortunately, that have noses that are just affixed in all sorts of odd shapes and places on their faces and are not all that pretty. And the way our teeth and our jaws and our cheekbones and our eyes and our hair and everything are all put together, the way we are, if we look at ourselves objectively instead of just naturally because we take ourselves for granted, what is really attractive about a human form or human shape? I've pondered that as I look at different animals, because I know that animals never look in mirrors, and some animals, well, especially fish, whose eyes are so affixed that they can't see themselves, have never seen themselves, and yet being school fish, they are instantly attracted to others of their same kind. They will dart about in huge schools, never wanting to be more than just an inch away from another fish that looks exactly the same way, and yet they've never seen themselves. How do they know they're not surrounded by a whole school of strangers? They don't. It's just instinct. But God put us together and gave us these natures and these minds, and He is the master potter. And He made us the way He did for a very great purpose. We're made in the very image and the similitude of God. And we need to get things in the correct perspective. That's all we are. Just so much clay, and He is the potter. And that our minds aren't anywhere near as intelligent and as perceptive and as gifted with the knowledge between right and wrong and what's good and decent and right and pure and so on and what is evil and ugly and wrong. So He says, why do we say of God, why have you made me thus? Hath not the potter power over the clay of the same lump to make one vessel unto honor and another unto dishonor? Now, this is a profound statement, and it gets right to the very heart, believe it or not, even of the 6,000-year plan of God with regard to whole racial characteristics. If your mind can probe some of those depths without getting into racism, then maybe you are a mature person, mature enough to realize that God, by allowing horrible sins to occur among some of the earliest members of the human race, even Lot, and committing incest with his own two daughters, from which Edom and Moab were derived, so the whole races of people, and some of the various races that inhabit some of the Southeast Asian and the Asian continents and the African and Indian continents, the Australasian Aborigines and some of these other peoples that have been there, might never really have been intended originally of God to even walk the earth, but there they are. I don't believe that all creatures that can be even selectively bred are intended. To me, when I see a dachshund that needs a roller skate to keep its belly off the ground, I don't know that a dog was ever really intended to be bred that long and that low slung and those short little old legs. I think the poor thing is miserable. There are certain dogs that have been bred to certain characteristics, such as Boston Terriers that are known because of their bulging eyes, to develop severe eye problems and to go blind when they're an older dog. And others that are very high strung and just nervous all the time and are susceptible to all sorts of diseases and problems. I'm not sure that some of those strains should ever have been developed in the first place, just as I am not sure that many human beings should ever have had children or should ever have even been born in the first place, and just as I'm not sure that even some races that walk this earth were ever really purely intended of God. And I am sure that in the millennium, God is going to begin a program to straighten it all out, to where that type of thing, which basically was sin, if you go back and study, as we did, and we went through just a little bit of it in the first six chapters of Genesis, and how then the sons of God saw the daughters of man, that they were fair, and took unto themselves all which they chose, remember, which showed that instead of obeying God's laws, and instead of marrying kind with kind and like with like, that there was absolute indiscriminate choice, and that gigantism and all sorts of deformities were the direct result. And as I mentioned, we had done some research and put together some papers that had shown the prodigious size and strength of some of the pre-flood fossil men that have been found, and the cannibalism was very heavily extant, and so on. Now in verse 22, what if God, and this is a little bit of a heavy philosophical chapter, willing to show His wrath and to make His power known, endured with much long suffering the vessels of wrath, meaning human beings, allowed to walk this earth, allowed to be born, fitted to destruction, in order that He might make known the riches of His glory on the vessels of mercy which He had before prepared unto glory. What if God decided to do that? Paul asked. And the answer is, of course, that's exactly what He has done. That He might make known the riches of His glory on the vessels of mercy, which he had afore prepared in the glory, even us, whom he has called, not of the Jews only, but also of the Gentiles. As he said in Hosea, I will call them my people, which were not my people, and her beloved, which was not beloved. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, you are not my people, there they shall be called the children of the living God. They were disowned. Lo-ruhamai, remember, in the names of the two children that Hosea had to engender as a result of a marriage with a prostitute. And that all in his life was a symbol of exactly what was happening between God and the nations of Israel and Judah. Isaiah also cried concerning Israel, though the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, a remnant shall be saved. For he will finish the work and cut it short in righteousness, because a short work will the eternal of the Lord make upon the earth. This has nothing to do with, quote, the work, as we had come to call it in the last 30 or 40 years, meaning everything being done by the church. It is the work, meaning the whole program and plan of God, culminating in the beginning of the kingdom of God. And as Isaiah said before, except the Lord of hosts, Sabaoth, meaning hosts, had left us a seed, we had been as Sodom and had been made like unto Gomorrah, completely exterminated. What shall we say then? That the Gentiles, which followed not after righteousness, have attained unto righteousness, even a righteousness which is of faith. But Israel, which followed after the law of righteousness, has not attained to the law of righteousness. Wherefore, because they sought it not by faith, but as it were by the works of the law. For they stumbled at that stumbling stone, and of course means Christ, as it is written, behold, I lay in Zion a stumbling stone and a rock of offense, and whosoever believeth on him shall not be ashamed. Then he goes on that his heart's desire toward Israel is that they might be saved. And he shows that Christ is the final outcome, the result, the object, the end of the law for righteousness unto them that believe. So these chapters of Genesis having to do with Jacob and Esau trigger a great deal of discussion, even in the writings of the Apostle Paul, having to do with the rituals of the law, the seeking of righteousness by work, ergon is the Greek word, or by constant repetitive religious ritualism and so on, rather than by faith through Jesus Christ. Let's go to the beginning of the 28th chapter. Jacob was asked by his aged father, maybe he was blind, but he wasn't stupid, not to be there and to marry some of the daughters of Heth, as had Esau, which were, of course, a plague to the others there, but to go on back to his own kind, to Laban, and to marry someone up there, to take a daughter of their own family. Now, actually, the way it would be that there was Abraham, Isaac, and then Jacob, and from Isaac came Esau, and of course, Esau, later on, as we're going to see, married one of the daughters of Ishmael, which would have been actually a daughter of his father's half-brother. So even there was marriage within very close family ties. In the 28th chapter, Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said, you shall not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan. Arise, go to Padan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and take thee a wife from thence of the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. And God Almighty bless thee and make thee fruitful and multiply thee, that thou mayest be a multitude of people. Now, repetitively, from the 12th chapter, the 17th, the 19th, here again in the 28th, and again a little later on in verse 14, the promise of race as opposed to grace is repeated over and over again, that the seed of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are ultimately to become many, many great nations, that they are to become a company or a commonwealth of nations, that they are to spread abroad into all the points of the compass and to inhabit the finest lands on the face of the earth. And it's repeated over and over again that that would be so. And give the blessing of Abraham to thee, and that thy seed with thee, that you may inherit the land wherein you are a stranger, which God gave unto Abraham. And Isaac sent away Jacob, and he went to Padan Aram, unto Laban, a son of Bethuel, a Syrian, the brother of Rebekah, Jacob's and Esau's mother. When Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Padan Aram to take him away from thence, and he was trying again to get in favor, he realized he'd made a mistake in marrying the daughters of Heth, and it's interesting that now he saw that the purpose of that journey, of course, was to go up there so that Jacob could marry a little more within the same family. And he said that he saw that he had blessed him and gave him a charge, saying, you shall not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan. And Jacob obeyed his father and mother and was gone to Padan Aram. And Esau, seeing the daughters of Canaan did not please Isaac his father, Then went Esau unto Ishmael, and took unto the wives which he had Mahalath. He kept the two he had, and took Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebajoth, to be his wife. So again, there were a lot of political marriages going on. And Jacob went out from Beersheba, and went toward Haran, and lighted upon a certain place, and tarried there all night, because the sun was set. That's where the dream came of the angels ascending and descending, and he called it Bethel, and it was called that way from that time all the way through the Old Testament, meaning the house of God. It had been called Luz, or Lutz, or however they would have pronounced it, and I'm not sure what that meant in Hebrew. And again, the Eternal gave him a vision, verse 13, seemingly standing above that ladder. Many people think that had to do with going to heaven, but it's very obvious in the verse that it means a reaffirmation directly from heaven, showing as if it were a door of access to the heavenly throne of God, and the Eternal standing above it and saying, verse 13, I am the Eternal, God of Abraham your father, and the God of Isaac. The land whereupon you lie, to you will I give it, and to your seed. And your seed shall be as the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad, to the west, to the east, to the north, and to the south. So all points of the compass, and the word abroad does not really place any limits upon it. And in thee and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you, and will keep you in all places whither you go, and will bring you again into this land, for I will not leave thee until I have done that which I have spoken to thee of. Jacob awakened, set up the stone upon which his head apparently was resting. Probably had some, camel saddles or some blankets or something else on top of it, but apparently there was this slab-like stone he'd actually use as a pillow. Now, if it is the very same stone, then there is a stone which is shaped about like an oblong or a rectangular slab, which is right underneath the seat of the coronation chair. Now, in recent years, Mr. Dart, they removed that, didn't they? After it was stolen that time, or did they take the whole chair and lock it up somewhere? I think they did, but I know the I've seen it four or five times. The first time was in 1956. But remember some years back in the 60s when somehow some crooks broke in there and actually stole the famous so-called Stone of Scone or the Coronation Stone, and they had it for some weeks. And they were trying to get a multi-million pound ransom or some sort from it, and I guess the police finally solved it and they got it back. And after that time, I don't know if it's on public display or not. It still is on display, probably just behind an area where people can't get at it. But if it is, it's still in Westminster Abbey. But I find that to be fascinating, that tradition remains to this day. And any way you want to slice it, whether you want to believe that or you want to reject it, is not material. What is material is that here is one of the most modern nations on the face of the earth, a great nation, a space-age nation, Britain, and certainly one of the most glittering thrones in the world. At the coronation of Britain, throne, of Queen Elizabeth II, and prior to that time, I remember as a boy of about five, listening to Big Ben and actually hearing all the descriptions and so on of the coronation of her father prior to World War II. And when she either abdicates or dies or whatever, and Prince Charles takes the throne, and that may happen within a very few years in our immediate lifetime, you're going to see another great, unbelievable coronation ceremony. And when that person is crowned, they're crowned sitting on a rock underneath that chair. And you just can't get around that. You can't wish it away or make it go away. And you've got to come up with some sort of a rational explanation as to why that is. And why did that stone have old iron rusted rings that obviously were made for carrying? And why do the traditions continue to be there by not just us, but many different organizations who believe in the identity of the American and the British people and the democracies of Northwestern Europe, that is in fact Jacob's pillar stone, the stone he set up, poured oil over it, and that it was carried with the Israelitish people throughout those days and went with the daughters of King Hezekiah during the days of Jeremiah up to the Irish islands, later to Scotland and later down England. And that the 25th chapter of Ezekiel that talked about, I will overturn it. Three overturnings. Once from Israel up to Ireland, from there to Scotland, from there down to England, and it will never more be overturned till he come whose right it is. And that is the very seat of the throne of Jesus Christ of Nazareth. I've got a strong hunch that the throne of Christ in Jerusalem is going to include that very same hunk of rock that is beneath the chair of the coronation throne of Queen Elizabeth II. That is not a proof. That is not a biblical doctrine. That's a quaint, interesting, historical concept. And it's just something that I happen to personally believe, but it is not obligatory on other people that they have to believe that, for sure. Now, there's something very interesting here they've argued over for years, but I'm not going to argue over it, but just bring it in, because there are several other things we've seen prior to even the beginning of the book of Exodus having to do with the law. The judgments, commandments, and statutes of God we saw last time were reiterated. The reason for Abraham's great blessings, chapter 26, verse 5, were because Abraham obeyed my voice, kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. What are we doing reading of commandments, statutes, and laws way prior to Exodus 20? We've learned of tithing way back before this time when Melchizedek appeared and Abraham gave him tithes of all the spoils. We've heard of clean and unclean back at the time of the flood when God revealed that seven pairs of the clean were to be taken and that only one pair of the unclean into the ark. There was no priesthood. There were no ceremonies. Yet we've learned of animal sacrifices. We have learned of the difference between the two blessings of Jacob and Esau. We've learned of the hatred between Cain and Abel. We've learned that even during Abel's day, the first and second sons born to Adam and Eve, that there was knowledge that the offering of a little firstling of a flock was like a sweet savor to God and was a forerunner toward the ultimate blood sacrifice for the atoning of sins, long prior to even the birth of Abraham. And Abraham precedes by generations the Israelitish nation that was to come 400 years in captivity after 400 years out of the nation of Egypt. And eventually, at the foot of Mount Sinai, was the establishment of a Levitical priesthood. What the Levitical priesthood did not usher in, then the disintegration of and the completion of the Levitical priesthood could not do away with. And the Levitical priesthood did not usher in clean and unclean meats, tithing, nor even the offering of an animal sacrifice. It ritualized, it codified the animal sacrifices and made them daily. There was the morning and the morning and evening offering. There was weekly, Sabbath, high day Sabbaths, and so on. It codified them in a sort of a ritualistic plan, but it didn't bring them into being. So let's notice toward the end of this, Jacob said, I was afraid, I had this dream, it's dreadful, I'm going to call it the house of God, the gate of heaven, the last of verse 17, rose up, took the stone, set it up on end, and poured oil on it, anointing it, and called it the house of God, Bethel, because the city was called Luz or Luz at the first. And Jacob vowed and said, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Eternal will be my God, and this stone which I have set for a pillar shall be God's house, and of all that you shall give me, I will surely give the tenth unto thee. There was like a contract, a covenant, and the way by which Jacob intended acknowledging that God was his God and that God was the source of everything he had was by tithing. That's all. It's a simple acknowledgement. If you're God and you give me the shirt on my back, he says so, the clothing I wear, the food I eat, then I'll give you a tenth of everything you give me. The simplest possible acknowledgement that everything that comes to us comes out of the ground. It grows out of the dirt beneath our feet, whether it's wool from the back of a sheep or flax that grows in the field. Whatever it is, doesn't matter. It comes out of the ground, doesn't it? It doesn't come floating down out of the sky. Everything you put on your body, everything you put in your mouth, everything you use, everything you see, comes out of the ground. And God is the one who gave those marvelous laws that by putting one little bean in the soil and tamping it down and praying that God will rain on it, or maybe that you can sprinkle it with a hose and have enough water to do so, out will come a nice big climbing plant and you get hundreds of beans. The only way in which new wealth, total new wealth, almost like a fresh creation, is ever really produced in this world is through farming. There is no other method by which new wealth that had never been there before is produced, because every ounce of gold that is ever mined is old wealth. And every recycling of an old beer can or taking of metals and things like that out of the ground is old wealth. But new wealth is the production of food. And the production of food is a miracle. I always think of it that way. That's why I really enjoy having my little garden and farming a little bit, because it's a way to stay close to God's good earth and to appreciate the laws and the miracles by which food is produced. Well, I'm going to stop with that. Are there any questions real quickly in conclusion? We'll take about a 10-minute break before the sermon this afternoon. Okay, thank you very much.